Scene 2, Martin Walters, 4:20 p.m. If I had arrived 20 minutes earlier, everything would have been different. Everything would have been well. And 20 minutes was exactly how much time I had lost on the cross north. The nameless idiot who had stalled his car somewhere near the Oak Avenue exit was therefore also a layer of flagstones. And yet, to be truthful, I was pleased at having arrived at 4:20 on the dot. I was Phileas Fogg making it around the world and back to the club on the second agreed upon. I even breathed hard as though I had been running when, except for crossing the crowded lobby at a reasonably brisk walk, engines and motors of various kinds had done all the work. I waited the usual 15 seconds for someone to notice me, but nobody did. I wasn't too surprised. The room was a madhouse, with ABA employees trying to herd the reporters, and the reporters clearly wondering, more or less out loud, how they were going to manage to put together any kind of wordage at all. Besides which, although I have avoided saying so till now, I am exactly 158 centimeters tall. It sounds good put that way, if you're not used to the metric system. But pass your hands over the figure and mutter the magic words 2.54 centimeters to the inch, and it becomes 5'2", plus the eyes of blue that go along with that height, and a fat lot of good that ever did me. Unless people know me, they tend to look straight over me, so after 15 seconds I let them know I was there. I've got a good loud voice and no compunction whatever about using it, so I said quite loudly and clearly, "I'm Darius Just, and I'm taking part in the Martin Walters press conference on the peace negotiators." It didn't make much impact, since most of the people continued talking as though it affected them not at all whether I was Darius Just or Just Darius, or simply Zero, and that didn't exactly overwhelm me with gratitude. I was about to repeat myself at a rather higher decibel rating when a woman walked up to me in an irritated fashion as though I had interrupted her at important work, which, from her standpoint, I suppose I had done. She said, "The Walters press conference?" I found out later that she was running the interview department for the ABA. Her name was Henrietta Corvus. She was just a little too plump for her clothes, and she had an annoying air of super-efficiency, as though she had 20 fingers with which to pull strings. "Got it first crack out of the box," I said. "But you don't. It's just finishing." I goggled at her for a moment, and then a horrible suspicion crossed my mind. "What time is it?" I asked, and glared at my watch. 4:22, she said. My watch was on the minute. "Well, then, 4:20 is the scheduled time." At that point, Martin walked out of the next room. There he was, full size, just over 6 feet, with his pleasant, grinning face, and with his pince-nez glasses of the kind you wouldn't expect to find outside a museum. Combine that with a tuft of white hair on his chin and a generous growth equally white on his upper lip, and he looked like a 19th-century literary figure. He was a gentleman, by which I mean he was someone who never, under any circumstances, alludes to my height. You'd be surprised how few such individuals there are. Perhaps because of his constant preoccupation with the past, he also had a remarkable shyness in connection with the greater liberality of language permitted by modern mores. Or maybe that went along with his gentlemanliness. For instance, I heard him quote the following limerick, which had been constructed by a friend of mine named Asimov, who'll play his part in these events later. It went as follows. "There was a young couple from Florida whose passion grew steadily torrider. They were planning to sin in a room in an inn. Who can wait? So they screwed in the corridor." When he quoted it, he blipped out the sixth word in the last line in a very embarrassed way. He actually said blip instead. And mind you, he was addressing an all-male audience. Would you believe a stag organization in these libbish times? Then, too, he said to me once with a look of good-humored indignation, "The trouble is that people use vulgarisms as general intensifiers, without any conception of the meaning. Like the woman who stepped off the curb on Park Avenue and said with deep annoyance, 'Oh, shit, I stepped in some doggy poo-poo.'" But before he uttered the exclamation, he lowered his voice to such a whisper that I almost lost the point. But now he was just grinning at me a little uneasily and said, "Ah, Darius, it was good of you to show up. You're a pal." "I'm a patsy, you mean," I said furiously. "You live so fiercely in the past you're incapable of giving me the correct time, present tense. You said 4:20, and I killed myself over crowded highways. I didn't, and they weren't, but I wasn't going to choose moderate phrases at this point, to get here, and you never waited for me. At this point, Martin might have broken the chain of circumstances by grumbling. I wouldn't have asked for much. He might have beaten his head against the wall, or licked my hand, or thrown himself on the ground and asked me to jump up and down on him. Any little thing like that. He didn't. He decided that what was needed here was a good laugh. So he gave me the old Santa Claus routine, put his arm around my shoulder, went ho, 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 and said, "Here's what happened, Darius. There's this woman who was up before us pushing some feminist book she wrote, and she came down in a practically transparent dress with practically nothing on underneath, if you know what I mean." I knew exactly what he meant. So? Well, her business manager said that was no way in which to greet the members of the press. "Why not?" I asked bitterly. "Are the newspapers recruiting 14-year-old boys these days?" "Well, no," said Martin genially. He was still seeing the humor of it. "It's just that they'd fill their reports with descriptions of her dress instead of a description of her book. Anyway, he sent her up to change the dress. That meant the press would wander off unless something was thrown at it at once. So, since I was there, they asked me to do my bit 20 minutes early. It couldn't be helped, Darius, but—" His voice dropped into confidentiality. "These conferences don't mean a thing anyway." It wasn't a catastrophe, you understand. Nothing terrible had happened to me. I had missed out on a 20-minute session that meant nothing, did not concern any book of my own, and would have bored me. But I had been made to look foolish in my own eyes, and I could not relieve my feelings by blaming anyone. A woman had chosen an unsuitable dress, a business manager had objected, an interview secretary had taken the logical action, a friend of mine had cooperated, and as for me, I had been held up by traffic for just the right amount to be made a fool of. If I had scooted through the Cross North without delay, I would have been at the hotel by 4 p.m. and would have moved in with Martin, taking full credit for being early. If I had been delayed 40 minutes instead of 20, I would have missed the press conference in any case, and the matter of its having been moved up would have been irrelevant. As it was, though, I was furious, with no satisfactory vent for my fury. No one had deliberately wronged me. I didn't have the heart to be angry with Martin, who had clearly been helpless, so I said, "Well, that's all right," and smiled unconvincingly. I wandered off angry and sorry for myself, and was all the angrier because I knew in my heart that the hurt had been trivial and that I was being childish. I was wound up and all set to wait for someone against whom I could find some reasonable cause for resentment, and when that person was found, I would strike out and strike hard. And in taking that attitude, however justified it might have been in purely subhuman terms, I was laying down the biggest flagstone yet, and was beginning to set up my own responsibility for murder, one which might have been greater than that of anyone else, including that of the actual murderer.